I just would like to thank everybody for coming here and participating in what I hope will be more a discussion than a talk. The basis for what I'm going to present is what I think I will try to present in San Francisco at the AGU meeting this coming Friday. But I will take the opportunity to have a relatively short talk for KRTP conditions, but nevertheless take a little more time than at the AGU so that I can explain certain things, and I hopefully can also extend a little bit on, elaborate a little bit on some other points that might be interesting to you. Those who have heard my previous talk, I guess more than 2 months ago, there is a fair amount of overlap in this here, but I will try to focus on the points that are have come up during my stay here. And I, in addition to my sparring partners for the earlier parts of this work, I would like to thank all those I have been discussing with here during this time. That has been very helpful and very stimulating. Just by way of introduction, let me just remind you of one or two facts. I'm not going to give any real introduction to avalanche dynamics, but just what I would like to say is snow avalanches are gravity mass flows that can change their mass quite drastically. This here is a measurement made in a small gully in the Italian Alps in the late 1990s by often the passage of an avalanche, cutting many, many trenches along the path and analyzing the mass balance locally there, and then interpolating this so as to arrive at a mass balance. This curve here, this is the starting point, this is the starting mass. This was a small avalanche with just about 100 tons of snow. The mass went up quite straight to about three times its initial value. Then it became, the track became more gentle and it started depositing while still eroding somewhat. So in the end, the mass that had been in motion at any point, at a given point, was basically four times the initial mass. But here you see that the mass goes down quite quickly because there is a lot of deposition. Then there is a very short stretch where the track becomes steeper again, so the entrainment rate shoots up, the deposition rate goes to zero, and afterwards the avalanche deposited again. So if you see this ratio here, it is quite obvious that this can have repercussions on the dynamics of the avalanche and should be taken into account when modeling these phenomena. And I should add, very early models from the 1960s had actually already in it entrainment terms and made some assumptions about this, but later on it was mostly forgotten or just neglected. And only in the past 10 to 20 years has this topic come up again. And the main reason for this, I think, is that people just don't know how to describe entrainment. Yes?
I have to ask for clarification what exactly it is that we're looking at here. So the left axis says mass as a function of time.
Yeah, that is, well, it should be basically, it is not time. It is, this is a publication, and the referee has not caught this here. This is not time, this is the track length. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you're talking about mass now as a function of track length. So track length is how far the avalanche has traveled?
Basically, you have a path like this, and the avalanche starts here, and then the water several points where cross-sectional profile was taken. And it was measured essentially how much mass was eroded at each of these points, how much was deposited, and this was interpolated from between sections, cross sections, and in this way it was possible to obtain numbers for how much mass has flowed through this cross section, how much mass has flowed through this cross section, and that is these points here.
I see. And so now.
And you see at the end it goes to zero. Basically, that's the toe of the deposit.
So when it talks there about mass balance and then parentheses T, so that does not mean mass balance as a function of time, but it means mass balance. So integrated over the time or what?
The person who did this did a fabulous job in actually doing it. This was a lot of work, but she is not a mathematician and she is not a physicist. And she did not catch that this is basically what she should write here is, in the case of this curve, it is mass flow or total mass that flowed through a cross section. It's the flow. There is no time involved.
Integrated over time.
Is it the two local measurements of how much snow has been eroded to?
Yes, right here. That is tons, yeah.
It's all massive.
Yeah. And this is meters. Yeah, sorry.
How did you make the distinction between erosion and deposition? And is it the.
Yeah, that is.
Quality of the.
Yeah, if you see a snow cover at the beginning, it's like this. You have certain layers. For instance, this here would be a relatively dense layer, and this could be a very fluffy new snow layer. And then after the avalanche has passed, or if this is besides, then you can make a profile somewhere else, and you find that this here has gone down to this. But you have to measure the density as well. So that you, Mr. Wei, to get better light.
Yeah, behind that clock thing. Who knows Georgie probably?
Yeah.
Tell us if it's a disconformity or unconformity or nonconformity of the snowpack he's looking at.
That's
unconformity.
So this is the initial density of this layer here, and this has density rho 2. Then this one will here have rho 1 prime after it has been compressed by the avalanche. And then you find that there is something like this with snow clots like that. So you measure the height of this and the density of that. For instance, rho 3 prime, so that's the deposit density. And then from this, you see that you can assume that this height times this density and this height times this density, if they are different, something has been eroded also from the old snowpack. But often this is not the case. It's so that then this height times this density would then match roughly with this height and this density. And so there could also be a situation like this, where you have here you have the debris, and here you have a compacted new snow cover with rho 2 prime. If not everything has been eroded, then some of this will be remain. So if you measure besides the avalanche and in the gully itself, these layerings and the densities, you can see how much has been taken away, how much has been deposited. And then if you do this for different cross sections and linearly interpolate, then you can get the mass balance. So you see it was done at quite a few points. Therefore, I say it was a lot of work.
So the mass there is the mass flux, right? Is that basically
it's the mass that flowed through the corresponding cross section. Yeah.
Integrated over the entire time of the
Yes,
avalanche.
Yes, because there, you saw, you know the, roughly the situation before the avalanche. During the avalanche, there is no information.
Yeah.
And after the avalanche, you go and dig.
At a given point, it's all the snow that was eroded above minus all the snow that was deposited above.
Yeah.
That's the mass of
that. Yeah.
And yeah. There can be simultaneously erosion and deposition.
Exactly, yes.
But simultaneous or?
In the same event.
Yeah.
Then typically it is the front, I mean, that is information that we'll see in the next slide. Typically it is the front that erodes and the tail that deposits. And what is nice here is that due to the relative good precision of the measurements, you see it really adds up quite nicely at the end. One gets the changes in the flow, and in this way one gets the time integrated deposition and erosion rates at different places.
So in the end, nicely it starts. Is there a reason why it doesn't start at zero? Is this like the avalanche already?
Basically, the avalanche was here, was released here, and the first cross section is below the Stauchwall. If you want to get time information, one of the best instruments, even though it has its problems, is frequency modulated radar that is buried in the ground, looks up and gives information basically on the backscatter intensity of at different distances. So this is time. This is the height above the radar in meters. So this here is about 10 meters from the radar. We had at this, in this special case, that was an avalanche at the Swiss test site Valle de la Sion in 1999, we had something like 5 to 5.5 meters of snow there. This was an extremely, was a very special situation there. And then we see the avalanche arrives and has flow depth goes down very rapidly. The snow height goes down very rapidly. And then the erosion rate diminishes somewhat until here, essentially the layer of an old avalanche, which with much harder snow, was encountered and erosion stopped.
Can one arrive from this spot whether there are any good layers in the avalanche, or you can go to the lines that are horizontal? In other words, can you get quantitative information still?
About the snow cover, I mean, this was not, this plot here is not very elaborated in the sense that one would have to do a lot of analysis in order to get rid of multiple reflections. This is, in principle, it should be possible. But this, I left the institute a year or so after these data were taken. And by then it was not done, and I think it has still not been done in any good way.
Not with the ground radars, but there are other groups doing ground penetrating radars from the top, and they are looking for weak layers.
Mm. In the deposit or in the
stone? Everywhere. Like they try to find layers in the deposit, and they do it with glaciers as well.
I mean, Google did some such measurements with these radars, but mounted on top of a sleigh and pulling them over the snow cover in the 1980s. So you see, this here corresponds to about 10 seconds, a distance of at least 300 meters in the avalanche. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of entrainment going on. Sometimes it might be almost discontinuous, and sometimes almost absent. But one has to be a little cautious interpreting this plot too much in detail, because essentially what we see is that when it is undisturbed like this, we know the snow cover is at rest. When we see disturbances like this, we do not really know what is going on. We do not have a measurement of the horizontal velocity, or of the vertical velocity for that. And so probably there is some shaking going on due to the shear stress exerted by the avalanche in this layer here, but it does not seem like this is being entrained. A question is, what is this here? Is this a deposition, or does that go through? My guess is it does not go through, and so that this really is deposition here at the end, but it's tricky. But generally, you can see something like this within 10 seconds, something like 2 meters of snow were eroded. If you assume that the density of that snowpack was around 150 kilos per cubic meter, that means 300 kilos per in 10 seconds, roughly 30 kilos per second and meter square. And so we get this ballpark number here for typical erosion rates in snow avalanches. And I should add one thing here. One sees that this erosion rate is very strong at the front. This has led Sovila and among others to claim that it is basically frontal erosion. But if one really looks more carefully, then this is already of the order of a half a second or so. So it is not real, and a half a second in this avalanche, that is a distance of about 30 meters. The front velocity was at least 60 meters per second, I think, or 50 at the very least. So that is already spread over quite a distance. And it does not mean that the erosive power of the avalanche really diminishes very strongly here, but it could also mean that the strength of the snow cover that limits the erosion rate is increasing with depth. That is actually what we should expect, because snow is partly a granular material. It has cohesion on one side, and it has granular properties on the other side. So if it is getting, if a shear stress is being applied, it means that the bigger the overburden is, the larger will be the shear strength it has. So it will, with the weight of the avalanche, and it will be stronger than if you measure just here for the undisturbed snow cover with no avalanche on top. And due to the weight that has been acting on the lower layers by the upper layers, these have compacted in the course of time. The snow behaves approximately as a viscous material over long times, and the density increases, and the strength of snow typically increases like an exponential of the density.
Yes. What is the kinematics of entrainment? Is the material being loose material being created and swept under the avalanche? Or is material, bulldoze material being thrown in the air, and which way is that?
That is, as most good questions, this is one I don't have an answer for. Mm-hmm. But I would venture to guess that it is both mechanisms. I'll come to this in the next slide. There is the possibility that the avalanche here approaching creates a lot of pressure in the snow cover. The snow, this pressure has to try to dissipate through the porous material that the snow is, 85% air. And so it will flow out of the snow cover and will tend to rip out parts of the snow there. This mechanism has been studied recently by Michel Louge and some of his colleagues and students. And even though one may be critical of some details of their computation, I think the basic idea behind that this mechanism can play a role, I think I support that. On the other hand, when you look here, I would think that this material actually has to be scoured away from the snow cover and mixed into the flow. But we would need velocity profiles and also vertical velocity profiles I mean, profiles of the vertical velocity in order to settle that, and we don't have any at this point. Jim, do you know of any measurements with the LED probes that would shed light on this question?
I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that that's happening. But I mean, it might do sometimes. If you plotted this as distance against distance, there would be an incredibly low aspect ratio of fun.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the question. The resolution, time resolution of the radar is not that great. So we cannot really say how sudden this erosion is. But it might, I mean, I'll discuss this a little bit in just a second. There is certainly some evidence for continuous erosion, and there are some arguments that would point to that rather abrupt erosion of chunks of material might also be possible. Here is what some 10 years ago I thought might be the main mechanisms in avalanche erosion. I'm going to focus in what the theoretical work afterwards, I'm going to focus essentially on this here. And one could subsume this here if one does some time averaging also in this here. So it is mechanisms acting along the bottom that I want to talk about. But I should really stress that frontal mechanisms are certainly active in dense, wet snow avalanches that are going slowly and plow through the snow cover. And this eruption mechanism is the one that we just talked about. So in this case here, if you think of the fact that the snow cover is layered and that there is typically a when there is an avalanche, there is typically a weak layer buried underneath the new snow cover. Then the strength of this top layer here in the snow cover might be quite a bit larger than the strength of a very thin layer on the bottom. So when the avalanche comes and flows over it, it is quite conceivable that the fracture goes along the weak layer at the bottom. And then a whole chunk would be released. And the question is, how does that go into the flow? I hope to come back to this at the end with some thoughts. So for the theoretical work, I want to make the following assumptions. So I restrict myself to erosion along the flow bottom. And then I have to make some assumptions that help or simplify the problem somewhat, assumptions concerning the properties of the snow cover. And if we think about snow, then it is clearly a cohesive material. So there is, in contrast to granular materials, where there is something like a friction angle of 30 degrees or so, you can have vertical faces in the snow because of its cohesion. Or even you can have cornices that hang over. So this is certainly, in this connection, a very important property of the snow cover. So to simplify what I assume is that the snow behaves as a perfectly brittle material. By that, I mean the following. If you apply a shear stress on the snow cover, it breaks. It doesn't do a thing. I assume it is essentially infinitely stiff until the shear stress reaches its strength. And then it breaks abruptly. That means that I do not need to expend any energy in order to break it in this limit. The elastic energy, k half x squared in this picture of a spring, becomes zero because k is infinity and x is zero. Then I don't have to think about energy. And there is no time delay between the point where the shear stress reaches the threshold and the point where the material actually breaks. So that simplifies things. But I don't think it changes anything qualitatively. If one were to include a little bit of energy that has to be used up to deform the material and to break it, and because that energy is essentially being furnished by the friction that is there anyway. So, but it makes the mathematical treatment quite a bit easier. And then what I want to stress, and what is really my interest here, is if you go back in the history of snow avalanche dynamics, there are tons of models that were, or not only snow avalanche dynamics, gravity mass flow dynamics generally, there are tons of models that were proposed for the entrainment rate. And virtually all of them contain at least one free parameter that nobody has any a priori knowledge about, and that is not directly relatable to physically measurable things. So if you want to calculate the entrainment rate, you have essentially to make a measurement in order to be able to use it in a model. What I try to do is to find a formulation that takes into account that physically it must be, the entrainment rate must be determined by A, the properties of the snow cover, and B, the flow properties itself, themselves. And so there should not be any free parameters. Now, let's first, in order to contrast different situations, let's first think of a very simple model. We have a bed, and we have a flow, which is basically a block. The block slides over the bed, and we assume that there is a friction law that governs the friction exerted inside or the shear stress exerted inside the flow and at the interface between the flow and the bed. And in addition, we assume that the bed has its critical shear stress or strength tau c. We assume furthermore that the shear stress exerted by the flow onto the bed is expressible as a function of essentially the vessel velocity and the flow height. Now from simple mechanics, we see that there can be if the flow is fast enough, there can be a discrepancy or a discrepancy between the shear stress exerted on the top of the interface and the one exerted at the bed, because the bed cannot exert more than its strength. So we get a jump condition for the momentum across the bed flow interface, and this means that material is accelerated from the bed and becomes part of the flow in that process. And by simple mechanics, then we find that that the entrainment rate is the difference between the shear stress. This formula was, this should be, I don't know why this came that way. This should be sigma b of u bar and h minus tau c divided by u bar. So it should be this formula. I don't know why that looks different now. So the this is an important factor here. It basically says if the flow is very fast, the entrainment, it has to accelerate the eroded material to a high velocity. So that takes a lot of momentum and decelerates the flow. So But it does not mean that the entrainment rate generally goes down as 1 over the velocity. This depends on how this one, this function depends on the velocity. In the case of the famous or infamous Fermi model of snow avalanche dynamics, which consists of a Coulomb term and a velocity square term, like in hydraulics, so that this k is similar to a Chézy coefficient, we can find the an explicit formula for the entrainment rate. If this quantity is less than the velocity, then there is no entrainment. That is the threshold velocity. If the threshold velocity is reached, then this is the formula for the entrainment rate. And you see, it has got one term that goes like 1 over the velocity, and it also has got a term that goes like the velocity. And in a model that is being commercially sold these days and used by, I guess, several hundred people around the world, there is an entrainment relation implemented that basically says that the entrainment velocity is equal to some constant, which is unknown, times the velocity of the flow. And so if one compares...
What happens when u bar goes to zero?
When?
U bar goes to zero and the flow stops.
Then you are below this threshold.
Oh,
then you're here. But you are, this is good that you point this out, because if you try to assume, try to apply this method to a purely granular Coulomb model, then it blows up.
So this is what Dick Iverson has tried. Maybe, okay.
I'm not particularly fond of certain parts of that paper that you allude to, because it does not answer these questions. This. Let me see. I think this is an EPS file, and it does not show on the screen. But here is the plot I wanted to show. This is the. For a specific example with a coefficient, friction coefficient of 0.3 and the turbulent friction, drag coefficient of 0.05, flow depth of 1 meter, slope of 30 degrees, and ratio of this here would be 3.0 meters squared per second squared, you get this curve for the entrainment rate. It goes towards a linearly rising function. Asymptotically, it's the same like this here. And the model implemented in the commercial code that predicts an entrainment rate somewhere like this. They recommend values between 0.2 and 1. So you see, it's an enormous difference here, which means basically that if you do this here, the avalanche entrains everything in the first cell of the flow, and then the rest doesn't get anything. Whereas in this case, it takes, with an entrainment rate of, say, 20 centimeters per second, it takes 5 seconds until the snow, 1 meter of snow is eroded. So the snow is much more evenly distributed. I implemented this, I tested the model a little bit on an avalanche that was observed in 1993 at the Norwegian test site in Rykfon. And I do not have data on to compare the prediction of the model, I would first of all need data on the snow cover strength, which is not available. I know the ballpark of these values, but I do not need more. I do not know more. And there were no measurements of the entrainment performed either. So this is basically just to show that the avalanche, in this case, with these parameters, really entrains most of the snow cover in the main part of the flow. And it reaches velocities that are still somewhat low compared to the measurements. This avalanche, I think, went over 50 meters per second. But that is a general problem of this type of model. And it is actually better with this entrainment model than in the model without entrainment, even though entrainment typically tends to slow you down in the beginning. And the reason for that is that, in contrast to the situation without entrainment, the bed friction is limited to the shear strength of the material. So there is basically no extra penalty, velocity penalty one has to pay over the non-entraining case. Yes?
Could you help me interpreting the right figure? So I understand that in the release area there's a lot of erosion.
No, that is just the release. I mean, there is no erosion here.
But it's called the erosion depth.
I should probably take in another color that is not in this scale here. This is just to indicate where the avalanche started. And I should not call this erosion depth. I have to change this. It is, in fact, the remaining depth of the snow cover. So here it is. I have to.
That's basically my point. Like the sides of the flow are higher in color, and there's more snow remaining. So
it basically means that the velocity was only part of the time below. Above threshold, so it did not erode as much. This does not mean it formed levees.
This is eroded all the way down to the base in the middle.
I did not change the topography, so when the avalanche erodes, basically a snow cover that was like this then becomes like that.
Yeah, so this is a trench.
So you get a trench, and that has a channeling effect on the avalanche. This is not taken into account in that model, in these calculations there. But somebody back there is working on that. He has implemented the change of the topography in the code, and is going to present that in a poster during the conference. And one sees, in fact, I'm giving away a little bit of the point here, but he found that it actually does have the effect of channeling the avalanche much better than it would be the case without the changes of topography. Takes a little more computational time because one has to adjust the topography and calculate new curvatures and slope angles and so on for the entire area every time step, but it does pay off.
And so the total amount of erosion in this simulation is not really different from the one if you use the other entrainment model. It's just the time at which it is eroded during the avalanche that is different. Is that right? Because the total amount of erosion is limited by the level of the freshly available snow.
I forgot to say it does not erode more than there is.
Yeah.
If it has eroded to the ground, then no more erosion.
So if you would use your constant times the velocity and use your value of 0.2 or 1 as suggested in the commercial software, you would get the same amount of total erosion, but it would just happen really quickly as the fault just hits the location.
Yeah.
And the whole dynamics would be different.
Yeah.
Like the whole chain would look different.
Okay. Yeah.
You would get like spreading the sides and stuff like this. It would look totally different.
Also, in this model, if there was, say, an ice layer which had a certain shear stress, that might be exceeded at some points when in the flow, where it would erode, and at other points not.
Right, yeah. The other model does not have any threshold.
Yeah.
And actually, when you are, this code is fairly dissipative, and if you do not take into account topography changes, then what will happen is that due to the static pressure in the starting or in the flow, a little bit of snow will go to the sides, and that will typically have fairly high velocities because of some deficiencies of this whole approach. And in the case of this too much simplified erosion law, this leads to a very large area around the actual avalanche that gets eroded, with minimal flow heights, but a lot of snow gets eroded. So in the end, really the avalanche becomes much huger, much bigger. And that is, of course, cured if the code does the right thing. But in this code, actually, it really highlights how this deficiency of the erosion model affects the whole outcome of the simulation. I mean, we should not make too much of these simulations. They're basically just for illustrating. I have not had the time yet to do this in a complete and exhaustive manner. What I am more interested in rather than this simple model, is a model for an erosion model for dynamical models that take into account a more realistic rheology of the flowing snow. And the one model I will focus on this time here is the so-called Noorem-Irgens-Schildrop model. I will come and explain that in a second. So the starting point is, I do it in the vertical plane for simplicity, is the momentum balance equation for where the momentum balance equation for just as a control volume. And I assume again that the stress tensor depends on H and the shear rate, which I abbreviate by gamma dot. I assume it is a simple shear situation for simplicity. And we have to obey the boundary conditions that the velocity at the bed must be zero. The normal stress in the normal direction at the top is zero. And in the case we have erosion, the shear stress at the bed should be equal to the strength of the snow cover.
All stress is normalized by some density?
Yes. Typically, when I write a hat, it means divided by the density. But here, it doesn't matter. Then there is a kinematic relationship, simple kinematic relationship between the erosion rate, the velocity profile, and the particle acceleration at the bed flow interface. Basically, the particle acceleration times the time, a time step, must be equal to times the shear rate times the distance it goes down in the snow cover. I can show it like this. At time t, you have this velocity profile here. During the time dt, due to erosion, this goes down, this distance dz. And the particle that was eroded here at time t accelerates in the flow to the velocity a times dt. And this velocity must be equal to the shear rate times this distance here. That's
U sub x is the x velocity of the velocity. It's not the derivative, right?
This is the increment of the u velocity, of the x velocity.
Yes, yes.
Of this particle.
Right.
So it is basically it's an advective derivative times the t time.
You're assuming that the velocity profile retains its shape, but just gets instantaneously gets sort of stretched to account for the new height of the flow.
Yeah. It's a while that I did that, but I think if you look at how should I say that, the changes in the velocity profile I think are higher order in time. So if you let dt go to zero, then you essentially I think you end up with the original velocity profile if in the limit dt going to zero. I have to check that once more.
There's no sort of time scale for the readjustment of the velocity profile, so it's equilibrium shape involved here. It's just you're just assuming it maintains that equilibrium shape always.
I mean, I'm going to use the assumption of in-depth average models of a constant velocity profile shape. That is right, and. There is the possibility of the profile changing. It has to be able to change. If I remember correctly what I did, then I found it was of the next order in dt. But we can discuss this. So essentially, that is then what we get is that the shear rate at the erosion front, in order to produce the shear stress equal to tau c, it has to be the critical shear rate that can be calculated from the rheology. And that must be equal to the actual shear rate in this case. And if we insert that dz, this distance that is eroded in time dt, is equal to the erosion rate times dt, then we get this expression here, and that can be written like this. So what we need to do, and this is a constant we can calculate, and so we need, from the rheology, we need to obtain an expression for this here. I made a 1D numerical code, 1D in the vertical direction, that solves this equation from given starting conditions. And here is an example of such a calculation for very unrealistic flow depths, of course, but just to show what happens. Here, this here, the red, is the flow depth. We start with 1 meter of flow depth, and the flow speed was at the beginning, I think, was zero, and then it accelerated until the shear stress at the bed reached the critical shear strength of the snow cover, and at that point the erosion began. And you see that at the end we have essentially it converges towards a constant erosion rate, this like this here, in the course of relatively short time. And what one finds is a sequence of velocity profiles as the erosion goes on. And the interesting feature is that these velocity profiles become more and more, apparently become more and more linear in the lower part, and only in the uppermost part show the curvature that is typical of the rheology. And In fact, you can. This was done for a Bagnoldian fluid. That is, the shear stress is proportional to the shear rate squared. But you can also do it for a Newtonian fluid, for instance, and you find essentially the same thing. The numbers are somewhat different, but and the shapes here differ also. But essentially, they show this linear velocity profile at the bottom. And also note that the shear stress at the bottom is limited. In this case, it was 500 Pascal. These are these curves here. And even though the flow becomes much deeper, the shear stress does not go up like you would expect. Or perhaps we should expect it. It does not go up. But the shape of the shear stress profile changes like that. That is due to the acceleration of the flow. The velocity actually increases linearly with time in this case, asymptotically. Now, I would like to have a solution for this that that does not depend on a numerical solution of the equation. Because if I have to solve a 1D equation every time step for every grid point in order to just get the erosion rate in my depth average model, I can equally well solve the 3D equations from the start. But in order to get an efficient model, I would like to have a depth average model and with an explicit formula for the erosion rate. So that is the goal. And then as a tool I use, or as a test bed, I use the Nurem-Irgens-Schildrop model, which in simple shear reduces to these formulas here. The normal stress is the effective pressure and the dispersive contribution. And the shear stress is a Coulombic contribution from the effective stress plus a dispersive contribution. This model was proposed in the late 1980s in Norway, and it has been used quite a bit by the Norwegians. Now, just going back for a second to this formula here. What we know this, of course. We can calculate this very easily. The question is, what is this here? For this, we would have to know the velocity profiles. But we don't know them without solving the problem. So, but if we look at this here, this suggests that we could try something taking it into account this almost linearity of the velocity profiles. And what I, after some trial and error, came up with just the last few days is something like this. If this exponent alpha here were 3/2, it would be the Bagnoldian velocity profile. But if we let alpha go towards 1, then we get a straight line. So that is what the velocity profile, that is the span of the velocity profile shapes that we have seen in the numerical simulations. So by letting this exponent alpha be a variable that we adjust to certain conditions that I just mentioned in a second, then we should be able to recapture the basic features of the velocity profiles that were obtained by the numerical simulations. Okay, then, what conditions do we have to fulfill? The velocity at the bed should be 0. That is fulfilled by construction. The velocity at the, or the mean velocity should be given, for a given mean velocity, we have to calculate UP and alpha. They have to fulfill this relationship, and then the velocity, the mean velocity, adjusts to the one we want to have. The other condition is, let me first take this one here, that the shear stress, the shear rate at the top, where there is no shear stress, should be 0. And the final condition we have to impose is that we have to have the shear stress at the bed equal to the critical shear stress. And that is means that there is a critical shear rate that should obtain at the bed. So that is the fourth condition that we have to fulfill. And the critical shear rate is given by this equation here, which you can derive from this here. I won't go through the algebra. It is fairly straightforward to do it a little. I mean, it doesn't help much to do it here on the screen, but the result. First, yeah. Here I just plotted a few examples of the velocity profiles that are obtained by varying this exponent alpha. I normalize it by the maximum velocity of the straight line profile, and here by the flow height. So this is the Bernoullian profile with alpha equal 3/2. This is alpha equal 1, and then for instance, for alpha equal 1.1, you do not see it, but if one really zooms into this point here, actually the tangent goes to vertical.
But here we are far away from any plug flow profiles.
Hmm. Yes, you do not get plug flow profiles in the North American Schindler model, unless you put in cohesion. Or if, of course, if you were if the slope angle, if you are at equilibrium and the slope angle is lower than the internal friction angle, you get plug flow. But at the same time, you find that there is no flow region, so the whole thing is at rest. So in this model, you cannot get a plug flow at the top. I mean, let me state one thing clearly. I do not mean to say that everyone should be using the NIS model. I'm using this as an example to show how one might be able to obtain explicit expressions for the entrainment rate that are consistent with the dynamics and not just inventing some fudge parameters that nobody knows what they are.
Because of the construction of your entrainment model, it can put onto any flowing geometry.
Yes, if you solve this equation, W equal and so on, G sine theta minus dz over d tau over dz divided by gamma dot c, then basically have that.
And what do you personally think? How should the velocity profile at lamps look? If you measure one compared to measurements, more plug flow like or more like this?
Depending on the situation.
Yeah, but generally it's a little bit more.
If it's a wet snow avalanche, a slow wet snow avalanche, then I'd go for the plug flow. Mm-hmm. If it is a somewhat faster granular wet snow avalanche, then it might be close to linear. If it is a strongly fluidized, fast, dry snow avalanche, I would guess that it goes fairly close, comes close to a Bagnall profile. But we have to measure profiles and look at them.
Okay, fluidized means entrained air?
Fluidized means that the particles are not in constant contact with each other. I mean, in the suspension layer, you have the whole thing becomes even harder because you have this big vortex at the front, and then you have perhaps if it is a long flow, you have very low velocities at the top, almost zero. And I don't want to make much more precise statements than that. So here I can hopefully go back to this mode. Once we have solved for these parameters, that's just algebra, then we are in the in a position to calculate this derivative here. And after some more algebra, one does get to this equation here. Hopefully I have not made any mistakes here, but I tried it more than once. And so you see there is a theta function saying that there is entrainment only if the shear stress at the bottom that is calculated is reaches this value here. And then we see that these terms here, this term is slope dependent. Gamma dot C is actually also slope dependent, and gamma dot C is slope dependent. That occurs here in the denominator, here in the numerator, here in the numerator, and here we also have the velocity. So if we assume that u were going to infinity, then this term here would drop out, and that would be our asymptotic entrainment rate. But there is a caveat here. And so the entrainment rate increases from some value to an asymptotic value. Yes?
You said that there are no free parameters, but the threshold for the shear stress is a parameter.
Well, it depends on what you think. Snow is not equal snow. There is no way you can a priori determine what your snow properties will be. So, but it is something you can measure in the field.
And what about dispersion coefficient? You have to use your closure parameters, right?
But they are given by the rheology. What I mean is that in addition to the rheology, I do not introduce any free parameters that are not measurable directly. Tau C, in a purely granular material, of course you cannot predict the mu value. You have to measure it somehow. And in a snow cover, it is not only, it is very variable. You have, from one situation to another, you have a variation. You have a variation in the vertical direction. You have a variation in the horizontal direction. So these are things that are, you cannot reasonably expect a dynamical model of snow avalanche motion to predict.
No, I just couldn't understand the sentence of no free parameters. We have to choose a rheology, so somehow.
Of course, yeah. But you have also, if you want to describe a gravity mass flow, you have to choose a rheology as well, even if there is no entrainment. Would you agree?
Each one of your parameters has some physical significance.
That is the point, yeah.
You're objecting to the kind of parameter that's in the commercial code, where somebody recommends that you take it between 0.2 and 1.
Yeah.
There's no entrainment parameter.
There's no entrainment, yeah. Perhaps I should switch no free entrainment parameter. Yeah. Okay, that's good. So what we see is also there is in this model, there is also an erosion threshold. And if the flow depth is given, the erosion rate grows with the velocity, but it is limited. And there are some two more things that have to be said. The model applies only if the Coulomb friction is less than the bed strength. If the Coulomb friction exceeds the bed strength, it means that even with no velocity, the substrate will fail. If just the material that is the avalanche lies on top, it will fail. Then, of course, this model cannot apply.
But that's what's happening in the starting.
Of course, yeah.
But it can't be. It's not really a weakness.
Right. But you have to know that this is a limitation, or it is. The model cannot be applied to the situation where the flow becomes so deep that already the Coulomb shear stress will be able to break the snow cover. Then basically what we get is something, I think, is that as the avalanche comes, there will be a catastrophic failure. And actually, this is something I really hope to discuss with you. Most people are sitting here, so I'll use this one. Slide. If we have
here
the ground, and here we have the snow cover, and then we have this big avalanche, and it flows over this as soon as the shear stress here acts, this fails. But the avalanche will not be able to, there is no solution from these equations. So what I think will happen is that there is some failure surface here, and this material will start to move like this. It will compress a little bit, and there is a like a shock wave going through the snow cover together with the advancing front, where there is basically a compression. And the question is whether one should, in this situation, go over to a description in terms of two layers, where one has one layer for the bed, two dynamical layers, one layer for the bed and one layer for the flow, and try to implement some shock conditions here, similar to the things that were done in the 1960s already in Russia, and try to describe it. Further back in the avalanche, so the velocity will basically be something like this. And this here is not the particle velocity, but the shock velocity. And so I wonder whether this might be a more adequate description in a situation where there is a catastrophic failure of the bed. I don't know whether anybody has some opinions on that.
Distinguish between the bed and the flow. Once you're in the region where the avalanche has moved over the top, so what's different between the two layers? Is it that the bed is still accelerating up to the speed of the other avalanche?
That is the idea, yeah. That it would take a while. Basically, in this model, as long as the failure is not catastrophic, the erosion proceeds slowly in this direction, and the velocity profile that was like this then becomes like that. And so basically the failure surface, or the interface, goes like that. And in this case, it goes all the way down at once. But it cannot move in with the speed at once, so it does take some time. So there is some, the velocity profile will probably look something like this here.
Yeah. So the way I see that is that the erosion rate, the time scale associated with that, has now become part of the time scale of the Oxford profile reaching its equilibrium shape.
Yeah.
And so there's another function.
Yeah.
But once you have that, then there's a whole lot of other stresses going on.
Yeah.
If the yield surface is not at shallow angle, there's a lot of other things preventing failure.
No. The question is, how can one make a sufficiently accurate yet sufficiently simple model of that?
I mean, it's one of these plastic yield type problems.
I suppose if you have a depth resolved model, then you can in some way do it. I mean, Crosta and Aldi have done some calculations for landslides with erosion that seem to work quite nicely, but that's, they made only a vertical slice because it was computationally very intensive. But perhaps the other solution is really to go back to what the Russians like Margarita Eglit did and have a shock condition here. It's basically saying this is one fluid and this is the shock line here. But in this situation, I was trying to, I was looking at this front entrainment model and was trying to find some way of adjusting the erosion height. We discussed this once. But in this situation, we know what the erosion height is. It goes all the way down to the ground or to the next stronger layer. So that is, I think, is one thing that should be looked at. And so the conclusions, I hope I have convinced you that the erosion function depends quite crucially on the flow rheology and that these two things are very intimately coupled. You cannot just invent an erosion function without saying what rheology you're talking about. If the erosion function is to be consistent, it should not have any adjustable parameters beyond the properties of the snow cover. And I think the stress boundary condition at the bed flow interface is really a crucial point that has to be taken into account. That is where we have a major distinction between the situation that obtains in snow and the situation that is being looked at by the people working with granular, dry granular materials. And I think this perfectly brittle behavior is probably a good candidate for snow avalanches and to some degree perhaps also for other types of gravity mass flows, but particularly for flow avalanches because snow really behaves like a very plastic material at low shear rates, and at high shear rates, already at low shear rates, it becomes suddenly very brittle. So you have to just shear it a little bit if you do it rapidly enough and it breaks. And that is the situation we have during entrainment in a snow avalanche. We should look at the frontal entrainment as well. And for the experimentalists, or for the people doing observations of snow avalanches, it is not enough to just observe the deposits and say so much has been deposited here, so much there. That is what you can get relatively simply by LIDAR measurements today. But we need more. We need more information. We need some way of characterizing the shear strength distribution in the snow cover, both in the horizontal direction and in the vertical direction. And furthermore, one should of course also do some more studies on these on different on erosion models for different types of rheologies. I think that's what I had to present. Thank you. Yes.
Where's the contradiction?
I made some calculations. I made I went. I had to travel to Los Angeles to get a visa, and I took the train, and that got me thinking and so on. And I thought, well, people love the Fermi model for various reasons. Can I perhaps find an erosion formula for the Fermi model? And then I thought, well, if I do not assume that the Fermi model is just a plug flow, but that it has a certain small shear region like this, I can try to apply a granular rheology, something like a Bagnoldian rheology or NIS rheology to this here, assuming that there is some parameter that is called the shear layer depth. And I got pretty far with that. I was very happy. The formulas looked, for a while, looked pretty good. But then I realized that at some point, this quantity here came in the wrong way. And then I realized that it really did not work out.
So then adopt the NIS?
And then I had to go back to the NIS.
Yeah.
I was hoping that I could find the formula here, implement it in my code, which works for the Fermi model, and does not yet work for the NIS model. And so I'm back to...
There isn't a good velocity profile reconstruction for the Fermi model.
Well, basically, I say if this is much smaller than the flow depth, then the velocity, if this is the plug velocity, then this is approximately this here. But if I introduce, in addition to this here, these same two parameters that I have in the NIS model, this the isotropic dispersion coefficient here and this here, the shear parameter, then I can calculate the shear stresses, the velocity profile here, and the shear stresses in the same way I do in the NIS model, and so I got pretty far. But the problem resides here.
In practical terms, your critical erosion. Shear stress there. You've got erosion really not kind of granule to granule. You've got block erosion, right? Is that what you're assuming, or is that what you actually have when you have erosion of these surfaces?
In this situation, yes.
Okay. So how would you estimate but if, in terms the critical shear velocity, the critical shear stress for something like that?
You mean practically or?
Yeah.
No. Basically, what I would think one should do is go in the field,
yeah.
And at many places,
yeah.
With a kind of a shear frame, there is this little frame that you put into the snow
yeah.
cover, and you have hooked it to a feather dynamometer. You pull and see what is the strength of the snow cover,
okay.
And you would have to do it at many places, and then you have to take away where you have made your measurements. You should take away some of the snow, do it a little further down, 10 centimeters further down, and so on, until you get profiles.
This is a very common measurement. I mean, they
yeah,
do,
it is.
They do hundreds of snow packs like this all over
okay.
Switzerland all the time.
Okay.
So
okay.
These
you
things.
Did that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they're probably not very precise. But then snow avalanche dynamics is not a very precise science either.
So you don't have the benefit of Shields' work in the 1930s then, do you, for this kind of thing?
Well, in the early days of snow avalanche research, people have been out in the field a lot and have done what they could.
Yeah, sure.
But I do not, do you know of any good data that shows how the shear strength is distributed?
There's tens of thousands of snow picks people have done when they measured this.
Mm-hmm.
We took lots of this in Japan. The problem is that what happens is that it's not a continuous measurement. When you do it, it will fail at a particular layer as the structure of the snow thing. So you can imagine in this model you have it going out continuously, but more it's probably micro.
Yeah, we'll probably have to
different failures of different blocks, but the continuum model is probably a pretty good approximation if you have a lot of these layers close to space.
I think one could use an approximation like this. The shear strengths could be something like a cohesion plus some friction parameter times rho times let's see. Where it is the slope angle, and so it behaves a little bit like a Coulombic material with a cohesion. And this friction coefficient would, in general, be different from the friction coefficient that you put into the dynamics model.
When people are assessing risk, they basically measure dips and then divide by the rho g sine theta
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah,
and see
yeah.
how likely each point is, how close each point yeah. is to failure.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that I think could be a first step forward. Sorry for the cookies.
Okay.